In a universe that almost is, just out of reach beyond the edge of reality, mysterious forces underlie the fabric of existence. Energemetra 6, the very energy of creation, serves as both the elixir of life and the arsenal of destruction for its human and not-so-human denizens.
Crushing darkness, whose source they cannot fathom, grips the cosmos and its people. In anguish, they dream of the long-foretold bright star.
Join us as we embark on an epic journey, exploring the universe of Energemetra 6.
Welcome, everybody. This is episode 26 of the Energemetra 6 podcast, and we are reading chapter 3 of The Veil of Mysteries. And thank you for being here, everybody. Thank you, Luke. Thank you, Mel. And Oldest. And, yep, looks like we're in good shape. All right. So, that being the case, let me hit our V for V ad, and we will get busy. The Energemetra 6 podcast operates on a value-for-value model. That means that we hope if we provide some value to you in your life, that you'll return that to us in whatever way you can manage. If you're interested, head over to e6universe.com and sign up for our email list to get our free ebooks, and hopefully buy a physical book or some merch while you're there. Or if all you can manage right now is to leave us a good review somewhere, 5 stars or some kind of positive rating, that's more than appreciated. Thank you. This is The Veil of Mysteries, Chapter 3.
An impenetrable shield is a blade of two edges, both pointed at those it defends. They who are protected from danger become soft, and lack of character is the rot that destroys empires. The Regalian Synodal Prescription, Book 2.
Lighthouse Station was set in the most picturesque location Nate could imagine. The nebulous clouds of the Veil reflected their rainbow of light into the system from every angle, leaving a vista without shadows, only multiplying shades of light and lesser light. The planet below was as beautiful as any picture he'd ever seen. It had oceans and continents, deserts and forests, and the colors were almost perfectly contrasted to the brilliant light show of space around them. Ironically, the station itself was reflective, making it blend into the space surrounding it, refracting the rainbow back to the eye so it merged with the background perfectly. It was hardly noticeable until it actually came between them and the planet. The station had 2 great arms that spiraled away from a massive central cylinder, with docking umbilicals at intervals along each arm. They were directed, again by radio, to dock an umbilical 1 on arm A, sunward. As they moved into position to dock, Nate couldn't help but notice there were only 2 other vessels on the same arm they had been directed to. One was similar in size to Adamant, but so crudely assembled it looked almost like a child's toy, molded of cheap plastic. The exterior was blackened and warped, and Nate wondered whether the ship was the victim of many trips through the planet's atmosphere or had been damaged somehow. The other was tiny, its central cockpit barely big enough to hold 3 or 4 people. It obviously wasn't intended for entry into atmosphere at all, with spindly, comical-looking connections between its core and other modules. Andrew's deft touch brought them into their docking station perfectly, but docking still took what felt like a disproportionately long time. Finally, the magnetic grapples securing them to the station were locked in place and tested, and an air seal had been formed to the umbilical. To enter the station, they pulled themselves hand over hand through a heavy articulating tube that looked like nothing so much as a tremendously large ventilation duct. As they neared the airlock, which was open and waiting, gravity began asserting itself upon them. No other space station any of them had ever seen could boast artificial gravity. It was almost, but not quite, enough to make them pause. They were all ready for a change of scenery, however, and eagerly, or in Kievan's case almost resignedly, followed Nate into Lighthouse Station. Nate was the first to cycle through the station's airlock, which was surprisingly only large enough to admit one person at a time. It seemed a strange choke point, and Nate wondered fleetingly why it was so small. His attention quickly turned, however, to the veritable crowd awaiting him on the other side. The foremost figure among them was an older man with iron-gray hair and a stern but friendly look about him. In a huddle around and behind him were six others, approximately his own age, four of them men and two women. Standing apart from this group, to Nate's left by the wall, were John and Rachel, along with Jesse Galton. To his right and behind the cluster in the center, others stood, craning their necks to see, or talking quietly to one another as they waited. When he stepped through the lock and into the room, everyone except John, Rachel, and Jesse stopped speaking in obvious shock. After a moment, a murmur ran through the crowd. Nate could tell the group was surprised, but exactly why wasn't immediately obvious to him. Without seeming to notice the other's shock, the gray-haired man stepped forward and bowed to Nate. "Lord Brightstar, I am Eldra Roderick Jabin. My companions are Bettina Strong, Alden Rebus, Elena Seaver, Neil Eden, and Regan Sorrel. We are the Council of Sanctuary, and in the Keeper's absence, we are responsible for Sanctuary. I believe you've already met Jesse Galton, and obviously you know the Kassizias." He smiled at John and Rachel. "We welcome you and yours to Lighthouse Station." Nate nodded to him in return, smiling. "I'm glad to be here, Elder Jabin. I hope my visit will be occasion for celebration rather than grief." Behind Nate, the airlock opened again and Ty popped through. "I've brought six others with me. This is Ty, Tyler Wrighton. He's most recently from the Telestry's Aqua Lucum." As the others came through the airlock, Nate introduced each one. When the airlock cycled for the final time, with only Kievan remaining to join them, there was another murmur in the crowd, and Nate turned his head to see Kievan, his own head bent and shoulders slouched, trying to slip out of the airlock to stand behind the others. He turned back to Jabin and smiled. "And I guess you already know Kievan Radink." Jabin's expression was closed, and he gave Kievan a long stare. "Yes, yes, we know Kievan." He didn't comment further, instead turning back to Nate. "We weren't expecting so many of you, but we do have plenty of room. Would you care to rest? Are you hungry? I know there's much to discuss, and I'm sorry to bring it up so quickly, but if you have any news of the Keeper, we would be in your debt if you'd share. Jesse told us that in your communication you said his father had been captured by the Dominion." Nate nodded. "Telestic Loridan told me before I left the Telestry that the Keeper was in the Dominion's hands." Nate's mouth twisted into a grimace. "He had opinions regarding why that might be, but I don't know anything more than that. I'm sorry." Jabin snorted. "Loridan, you haven't put too much stock in his counsel, I hope." Nate smiled crookedly. "I trust the Telestic will see to his own interests in the Telestries. Beyond that?" He shrugged. "In this case, though, I think he was being honest." Jabin nodded thoughtfully. Behind him, the expressions and body language of the rest of the council ranged from obvious distress from Elder Yelena Seaver to reservation and doubt in the case of Elder Neil Eden, with several variations between. Jesse Galton, meanwhile, stepped forward away from the wall and said,
"You showed me Father's sigil when you calmed. May I see it?"
Without hesitation, Nate pulled the sigil from around his neck and held it out for Jesse to take. With real reverence, Jesse took the amulet, which darkened immediately as the chain left Nate's skin. As Jesse cupped the amulet in his hands, slowly, the glow returned.
It's real.
Jesse's face fell visibly.
I mean, I knew.
He shook his head and carefully held the sigil out for Nate, who hesitated, wondering if he should perhaps allow Jesse to keep it.
He said it was to be yours,
Jesse said, his voice intense. But after Nate took the sigil, Jesse turned away toward the wall, hiding whatever emotions had momentarily surfaced. As she and John stepped toward him, Nate saw Rachel reach over and squeeze Jesse's hand in sympathy, then turn to face Nate. It's good to see you, Nate said. John smiled and nodded, and Rachel stepped forward to give Nate a hug.
It's good to see you too,
she replied.
We've been...
She broke off, eyeing the council.
Jesse told us Hope One is here. That's our, Dad's old ship. We've been hoping to go see it.
Elder Rebus cut in with a frown.
It's too dangerous. The traps.
Jesse, in turn, cut in smoothly over Elder Rebus.
The council has yet to make a determination as to what course we should pursue. This is one of the matters we hope to resolve over the next few days.
Nate nodded thoughtfully, then turned back to Elder Jabin. Maybe it's time for us to see our rooms. The trip through the veil was a bit hair-raising. I know Andrew and Shauna could use sleep. Jabin gestured to the primary corridor leading from the docking arm into the station proper, starting off. As Nate walked beside him, he heard Shannon ask Jesse how the artificial gravity in the station worked. Jabin must have heard the same conversation, because his lips quirked and he glanced over at Nate.
This station was built before Paul ever left us. Some of the tricks he knew from before the escape, or invented himself.
Jabin shook his head. This station's a marvel. We hardly have the knowledge to do maintenance anymore. If it was ever seriously damaged, we wouldn't be able to fix it.
Nate nodded once more, looking around at the station as they walked. The floor was made up of some kind of resinous material, with little bits of polished, cream-colored stone embedded in it, resulting in a durable surface that reminded him of hard rubber. The ceiling was higher than Nate would have expected in a space station, made of some kind of smooth white composite, while walls of the same material were colored white at the top, fading to a light blue near the bottom. Everything looked old, but well maintained, from occasional professional patching of the walls and ceiling in a few places, to the mechanisms on the hatches leading off the corridor at intervals. Indirect lighting fixtures dotted the upper walls, and it was obvious the station's designers had done their best to make the station feel expansive to its residents, even at the cost of precious interior space. Nate raised an eyebrow at Jabin.
Keevan said most people live here on the station instead of on the planet. Why is that?
Jabin smiled wryly.
It's true. The planet isn't a very friendly place these days. We're told it used to be cooler. It was almost as nice as a Terrier, even. When Paul put the veil in place, the sunlight reaching the surface increased drastically. He smiled ruefully. Unintended consequences. The reflected light raised the average temperature 30 degrees. It's still of use to us, of course. We get most of our food from the planet. The heat doesn't keep us from growing crops and livestock there. He shrugged. It's enough to keep us all fed, and a few hardy souls live there full time. It's not for the faint of heart, though.
Jabin looked around at the people walking with them.
We have a few thousand people aboard Lighthouse. We've only filled up the lodging twice in our history, and it's been almost 100 years since the last time that happened. There are always a few who want to leave in every generation, and the Keeper made sure none of us ever felt like we were in a prison. He always took anyone who wanted to leave into the outside.
A few even came back. He glanced back at Kevin, trailing well behind the rest of the group alone. Nate nodded.
I don't suppose you do any trading here.
Not as if you get many unexpected visitors.
Jabin laughed.
Only once in our history before you. The famed visit of Siva Redding, the wild man. The keeper brings in a trader or two sometimes, you know. Now, before Paul put the veil in place, we had a pirate ship threaten the station once. Of course, Paul was aboard at the time, so it didn't go very well for them.
Jabin continued to talk of times past while they walked, but Nate was only half listening. There was something that felt right to him about this place. It was clean. Not just physically, but in a way he couldn't quite express. The people in the crowd that followed them were friendly and happy, laughing and chattering to each other as they walked. A few wore tools on their belts, but there were no weapons in sight anywhere. The few pieces of jewelry he saw were simple and tasteful. One woman had a necklace with a crystal cut similarly to the Sigil of Mysteries, though smaller. There was no pretension of power or bustling obliviousness. Once or twice, as he walked, Nate heard the sounds of children playing down a side corridor. Nate already loved this place and its people, despite what he could sense was a council so set in their ways and used to the rightness of how they lived that they would perhaps sooner die than change. In a sense, they were right. They were set in their ways because their ways had worked for 1,000 years. They were happy because the way they lived was simple, and they loved each other. He could see it in how the people walked, obviously together, obviously part of a whole. Their community wasn't perfect, but it worked. At first, Nate felt a warm happiness inside, like a glow surrounding him as he walked. Then he recognized what he was feeling, and his guts twisted. He could feel at home here. When they reached their rooms, Nate's impression that the people weren't pretentious or power-hungry, like those at the Telestry, was confirmed in another small way. Jabin showed him into his room first, then bowed again, looking embarrassed.
It's the best we have. The station was built for colonists, not for visitors, I'm afraid.
Nate looked around the simple room, plain but sturdily furnished, and shook his head, smiling.
This will do perfectly. Thank you.
Nate later discovered that they had arrived in the middle of the station's night cycle, and thus he overslept their normal wake time by several hours. Again, he found himself caught in a nightmare from which he could not wake. What finally roused him was a banging at the door to his quarters, cutting through the darkness in which he was trapped. As he tumbled out of the low bed, Nate felt a strange sense of duality, as if his mind was in two places at once. He was so clumsy in getting to his feet that it took all his concentration just to stumble to the door. He leaned on the wall, gathering himself before he finally opened it. When he did, Rachel burst through like a towering storm cloud. She swept past him into his room, her expression thunderous, only to stop dead still when she realized the lights were still out and he was blinking away the remains of his troubled sleep. Rachel cleared her throat, and Nate could see her face going just a bit pink, even in the dim light. Outside in the corridor, he heard John burst out laughing. A moment later, John followed her into the room as Nate turned on the lights.
Oh, Rach,
John said through his last gasps of merriment. Nate was grinning also as he turned to Rachel and raised his eyebrows in question.
So, good to see you. What's up?
Rachel swallowed audibly, then nodded and turned to him, her obvious embarrassment once more giving way to anger, though more controlled now.
They won't let us go.
Go? Nate asked, his eyebrows raising further. They're trying to keep you here?
No. They won't let us go to the ship.
Rachel was seething.
That snake Rebus has led the charge against us ever since we got here. I think they decided to quit waffling because you finally showed up, but they went into closed session this morning and they decided not to let us go. Jesse said he was the only one who voted for us.
Jesse's on the council? Nate asked.
Of course. He said they were concerned about what trends it might encourage. Hope One is the only home we have left.
Nate nodded slowly. Andrew picked it up on sensors when we were coming in.
It's orbiting the big gas giant. It's just not right. Hope One was Dad's, and now he's gone, and it should belong to us.
Rachel seemed on the verge of tears now. Nate frowned. So are they guarding it, then? Rachel snorted.
They can't even get close to it. The vessel is protected. Dad was the one who set up defenses for it. He told them there was a shield around it. And there are probably traps, too. They couldn't get to it if the Dominion were invading and all their lives depended on it.
Nate nodded thoughtfully. You're right. They can't stop you. You do have a right to go. I'll ask if Andrew will take us. Rachel blinked at him.
But... oh.
Nate looked at her again, questioningly. Did you agree to abide by their decision? John smirked.
Hardly. She was ready to throw them all out an airlock. She probably could have done it, too.
He grinned at her. Rachel was deflating visibly now, and she looked embarrassed.
I'm sorry, Nate. I shouldn't have.
She trailed off with an uncomfortable shrug. It was Nate's turn to snort, and he smiled, shaking his head. It's okay, Rachel. Now that I'm awake, can you tell me what happened after I left you? Rachel shrugged.
There's not much to tell. Taryn brought us here. He taught us more about the schemic and how to imprint while we were on the way. When we got here, he got called away again after only 2 days. The Dominion must have taken Malik when he left the Vale.
John made a face.
The Council all followed him around like puppies. Then, when he left, they started acting like they were on the show. Really, they're just snarling at people behind his back.
Nate stared at him, soberly. Something tells me that will have to change sooner than later. Then something occurred to him, and he turned to rummage through the few belongings he'd brought aboard Lighthouse Station. I didn't get a chance to show you this before. It's the letter the Keeper gave me when we first met. It's from your dad. John and Rachel both crowded in closer to read as Nate sat down on the bed, considering.
From Paul Kassizia to the coming Bright Star. Written on the eve of the disappearance. Preserved by Taryn Galton, 610 NST. I do not know who you are, but I know that you will come. My compatriot, Siva Ratting, tells me he has seen a vision of a great light, hurtling into our universe, bent upon defeating the enemies that beset us from every side. Siva may be odd, but his visions have never failed to come to pass. Thus I write to you, Bright Star, to give you whatever blessing I may, and perhaps to arm you against the evils you will face. I've all but lost hope. The Nocifer, the Ilvane, and especially the Opterans plague me. Even those who are still truly human are fractious. All the mortal powers are like flies, waiting to bite me the instant I turn my attention to something more important. It has been 1,000 years since we fled, and we brought so little with us. Our history has been lost. I have only the dreams to remember Earth. And they are nothing but terror. I thought we had left Lastus Rowland and his ilk behind us when we escaped Earth that was. I was wrong. Or perhaps I misunderstood the threat from the very beginning. I fear I have failed this universe over which the Lightmaker set me as guardian. They have won. All I can do now is delay them. But I didn't set out to complain to you of my own problems. I feel the burden of the looming darkness. I had to warn you of the evils I have failed to overcome. I do not foresee this universe becoming safer when I am gone. I hope I may forestall its destruction, but I cannot imagine prevailing against the many-headed void spawn that besets us. For every head I cut off the beast, it grows two more. I must leave vanquishing it to you. I have entrusted this letter to Terran, my son in all but blood. You see, they have taken even my children from me. If you are able, do me this one service. Find them. Find John and Rachel. Free them from their prison. I know they will fight at your side. Look for the mysteries. I've hidden them well, but allow hope to lead and you will find them. They may aid in your fight. The mysteries are far too powerful for me to allow them to fall into their hands. I thank you, Bright Star, for your part is to complete the task that I have so thanklessly begun and at which I have so spectacularly failed. Truly yours, Paul Kasizia, Guardian of the Remnant. As they finished reading, Nate was frowning thoughtfully. Do you suppose he was talking about Hope One? Could he have put something aboard? John and Rachel looked at each other for a moment. Rachel's eyes were full, but that didn't stop her from nodding decisively.
If he left us anything, it's definitely aboard Hope.
John's certainty was no less than Rachel's, and Nate nodded in return. All the more reason to pay a visit. He raised an eyebrow at the other two. Do you know where we could get some food?
The Energemetra 6 podcast is made possible by North Arrow Coffee. North Arrow Coffee is the pro-life coffee company where 15% of every purchase goes to support organizations like Crisis Pregnancy Centers, whose purpose is to support women in the most difficult situation of their lives. If you're interested, head over to northarrowcoffee.co and use promo code E6 to get 10% off with your order.
The advertisements featured did not necessarily represent my endorsements or views.
And that concludes Chapter 3 of The Veil of Mysteries. Thank you for being here, Mel. Thank you for working through the technical issues. Thank you, Luke. Thank you, Oldest. And Third is here because we thought he had lines too, but he didn't. So thank you, Third, as well. I appreciate you taking the time, everybody. And thank you to our audience. Appreciate everybody, and we will catch you all next week.